You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Larry Kotlikoff. How are you doing?
Great, Glenn. Great to be with you.
It's very good to have you. This is indeed Glenn Lowry. We're at the Glenn Show here at bloggingheads.tv. I'm a professor of economics at Brown University, and I'm speaking with Lawrence Kotlikoff, who is a distinguished professor of economics at Boston University. An expert on many things, among which are public finance issues, taxes, healthcare and social policy, Social Security. The man knows a lot of stuff. So, Larry, thanks for sharing some of that wisdom with you. Here's why I called you onto the show today, and I really appreciate you being willing to talk with us. Tax reform is in the air. Whether Trump gets impeached or not, I assume that eventually all of the kerfluffle will die down and people will get back to business in the United States House of Representatives, which is where tax legislation originates. The Republicans have come up with a plan. The president has made various noises about tax reform. So this issue is going to be with us. And I was hoping that you might be able to help me and the audience understand a little bit better what's at stake in the debates about tax reform. I say this in particular because I'm aware of the fact that you had a piece in the Wall Street Journal just last week on Thursday, May 11th, addressing yourself to this question. So I'm wondering if you'd outline the main argument of that piece and then, just engage me in some conversation about how you see the key issues and where you come out in the debate.
Okay, so the plan that the House Republicans have is called the Better Way Plan. And then the president has his own plan. We'll call it the Trump tax versus the House tax. And the both of them involve simplification of both business taxation and personal taxation. So on the personal side, the number of changes, many of which seem to be quite regressive. For example, the top tax rate, which is now 39.6%, will go down to 33% under the House plan, 35% under the Trump plan. The both plans would eliminate the alternative minimum tax. They would, I think, both raise the standard deduction. The House plan would eliminate exemptions. It's not clear that the Trump plan would do that. There's also something that's rather, that's rather actually progressive, in that both plans would eliminate any deductibility of state sales taxes or local taxes, like DC taxes, for example, and they'd also eliminate any deductibility of property taxes. And the rich, I think, disproportionately benefit from those deductions because the poor are generally being generally taking the standard deduction, so they can't make use of those particular deductions. So there are some progressive elements to the personal tax side of these reforms of these two plans, but in the main, they're both revenue losers and also regressive. So that's the first thing I said in the journal article, that on the personal side, they're kind of similar. They're both likely to lose a lot of revenue. One of the big issues on the personal side is that pass-through businesses, so if you're a proprietorship or a partnership or a subchapter S corporation or a limited partnership, right now the income that you earn under the current tax system is subject to taxation on your personal return. So your business income from running your small business, you have to treat that as personal income. So Trump wants to tax that pass-through income at a 15% rate, and the House plan wants to tax it at a 25% rate. At a 15% rate, there's going to be a huge potential here for tax evasion. For example, Glenn, you could quit teaching at Brown and have them hire you back as a consultant. And in that case, this is a Glenn Lowry Enterprise, Inc., you would then be taxed at a 15% rate on all your salary from Brown rather than at the 33% rate the 35% rate under the Trump plan. In the case of the House plan, it would be you'd be taxed at 25% versus 33%. So there's a bigger evasion problem with the Trump plan. So I think there are ways to deal with that, but it's not clear from the Trump plan, at least, how they would limit that tax evasion or avoidance, that transformation of everybody into a small business to avoid taxes. And if that happened, we'd have a huge revenue loss and also the end of progressivity when it comes to tax, the personal income tax. So I don't think the Trump plan is too well designed on that, you know, on that basis alone. And but let's go back to the House plan and first of all talk about the business side of the House plan.
Okay, let me interrupt you a minute, Larry, just to to clarify my own thinking about some of these issues. So you've mentioned regressivity, progressivity, and you've mentioned revenue loss. And then you've also called attention to some peculiarities that could be troublesome in the Trump plan, but that both of them engage in some broad reforms. The elimination of the deductibility of local real estate taxes, for example, sounds like a big one to me. So just as a matter of principle, I mean, we hear this language all the time, tax cut for the rich. The rich are getting 87% of the loss of the, you know, the gains from this or that and the other. You know, you're a hard-headed economist. You're looking at the numbers. How big an impact on inequality in the country?
Well, that's where, yeah.
Is the one way or the other of cutting the tax reform issue?
So to answer that, I have to tell you about the House, the business tax provisions, because they're actually quite progressive. So there's this progressive business tax reform. Now, it's not clear the Republicans or the Democrats understand it, by the way, but there is a pretty progressive business tax reform here. And then there's this regressive personal tax reform. If you put the two together, and I've just completed a study which is posted at kotlikoff.net. It's a study with Alan Auerbach, who's, as you know, a top public finance economist at Berkeley. So we looked at inequality as it now exists under the current system and how it would be under the House plan. We found that basically there would be very little change in the distribution of spending across low resource, middle resources, high resource, top resource individuals. If you look at it within a cohort, for example, 40-year-olds, the top 1%, their share of total spending that they get to do barely changes if you go to the House plan, and their share in the top, the bottom 20%, their share of total spending barely changes as well. So let me explain why the business tax reforms that are being proposed by both the Trump plan and the House plan are potentially quite progressive, and also what they could do to the economy in terms of stimulating investment in the U.S. and therefore higher GDP and higher wages.
I want to warn my audience that you are about to say something good about the Republican tax reform plan.
Anyway. Yeah, I'm basically a supporter of the House plan. I give it a pretty high grade. I would like to see it supplemented with an elimination of the ceiling on the FICA tax to make sure it's progressive and to make sure it generates enough revenue going forward. But even the way it is written now, I would support it and have said so in publicly. The Trump plan, I'm not really that keen on because I think it will lead to massive tax avoidance and will be less progressive.
Got it. Okay, so tell us about the House Republicans' plan on the business tax side and why you think it's progressive.
So what the House Republican plan is doing is it's taking this corporate income tax and it's turning it into a cash flow tax. And the way that works is all the revenues that come in are added up. Then you, as a company, you get to subtract off all your costs of goods. And then you also get to subtract out your wages, your wage payments, and you also get to subtract out your investment. And then there's something called a border tax adjustment. So if you import goods, you cannot deduct those costs. And if you export goods, you don't have to include those revenues. So that's what's called the BAT, the Border Adjustment Tax.
I want to come back to that because that's been very controversial as well, yeah. The Border Adjustment Tax. But go ahead with the
basic.
If
you put all the pieces together, what you have is the tax base under the House reform is a value-added tax and a wage subsidy. It's a combination of a value-added tax and a wage subsidy. So any public finance economist who can do national income accounting can, you know, put this together and see that that's exactly what's being taxed. This, again, includes the border adjustment tax, but that's needed to get to be taxing value-added entirely. And then again, there's this wage subsidy. Now, what is value-added, a value-added tax? It's really a backdoor consumption tax, a tax on consumption, because basically you're taxing value-added output of the economy, but you're allowing a deduction for investment. Investment is equal to saving, so you're really taxing output or income minus saving, which is equal to consumption. So think about what's going on here as the Republicans proposing to tax consumption, but also to subsidize wages. So that's very important because we pay for consumption out of our wages and also out of our wealth. But if the workers are being insulated from this consumption tax that's being proposed because they're going to get a wage subsidy, then they're not actually going to have to pay this consumption tax on net. It's just, you know, the wage subsidy is offsetting any burden of the consumption tax on workers. So what you have here, what you're left with is a tax just on consumption out of wealth. So this is an indirect tax on wealth that the Republicans are proposing. I doubt that most people, most Republicans in the House and the Senate understand that this is actually a wealth tax that they're proposing. And that a wealth tax obviously is quite progressive compared to the alternative. Now, the alternative, which is the current status quo tax, which is the corporate tax, a lot of people think that that's falling on the rich, falling on the owners of shares of stock. But my view, based on a lot of simulation work, building large-scale simulation models where capital can move out of our country into other countries in response to the relative tax incentives of operating here versus abroad, my view is that the corporate income tax is actually a tax on workers, that the workers are paying the tax because the capital is moving away, and when it moves away, it leaves the workers behind, and they have fewer companies bidding for their services, so wages end up lower than what would otherwise be the case. So think about this, Glenn. My view is that the business part of the House tax reform is going to eliminate a tax on wages and put on a tax on wealth. That's very progressive. When you include that with the regressive personal side, you get something that doesn't change overall progressivity. That's basically the same inequality as we now have. But the positive thing that the simulation models show is that this could lead to an increase in wages of about 8%. So you can get a significant inflow of capital, at least in these models.
That's huge, Larry.
That's huge. Well, you know, the corporate income tax, the marginal effect of corporate income tax in the U.S., according to Jack Mintz, there's different points of view on this, how big it is and how much it would fall based on the House plan. But Jack Mintz is a top public finance economist in Canada. He's not a Republican or Democrat. He's Canadian. And he's been working these kinds of numbers for decades. And his estimate is that the current effective marginal tax rate for investing by corporations investing in the U.S. is about 34.6%, and that it would come down to about 16.4% under the House plan, drop dramatically. And all the other major developed countries and major developing countries have much lower than 34.6% marginal tax rates. So if we come down so much, then the U.S. will be much more attractive with respect to investment.
Yeah, and, yeah. Go ahead. Finish your sentence.
Oh, okay. Well, and that's where you get the increase in capital coming into the U.S. So there's going to be more plant equipment, residential structures, and that can lead to higher wages, make workers more productive because they'll have more capital to work with.
Okay, I just want to reiterate a couple of things, Larry. I'm sorry to interrupt, but there's much more to the story, and I want you to go ahead. But let's just see if I'm correctly summarizing the lay of the land as you've laid it out here, which is that the Republican plan to eliminate the corporate income tax as we know it and replace it with another system of taxation. Corporations will still be paying taxes, but they'd be paying taxes in effect on the net difference between the monies they take in and the expenditures that they lay out for goods, for investment, and for wages.
Right.
The effect of this would be to lower the corporate tax burden. And since capital can move and basically labor cannot move, a high tax on capital can be partly avoided by companies taking their operations offshore, which ends up not helping workers but hurting them. Reduction in the tax on corporations, the effective tax rate that corporations would have to pay, because wages are being implicitly subsidized since they'll be deductible for corporations from their tax liability, will have the effect of reducing the incentive that corporations have to move abroad, strengthening the position of workers in the labor market, and therefore redounding to the benefit of workers, notwithstanding the fact that corporations are no longer obligated to pay an income tax.
Right. They don't have to pay a corporate income tax. They do have to pay this cash flow tax.
Yeah, a different kind of tax that is less burdensome on them, but is also, if I follow you indirectly, of substantial benefit. 8% increase in real wages from a tax shift. I find that number to be huge. Real wages have been flat for the last two generations.
Yeah, it is huge, and but that's what comes out of a very bread and butter neoclassical life cycle model, because our tax rate is quite high compared to other countries, according to Mintz's analysis. He's been studying marginal effective tax rates across a wide range of developing and developed countries. So I do think that this is one of the few cases where supply-side economics can actually work. In our model, if you just cut personal taxes and think that people are going to work that much more in order to, and that that's going to pay for itself in terms of extra revenue, not the case. Because, you know, you're familiar, Glenn, as I am, with the competing forces here. There's this income effect that we economists reference, which says that, gee, if my tax payments are lower, my tax rate is lower, I've got more income, I'm going to consume more, I'm going to spend more, and that's going to reduce saving and reduce investment in the country. And then the other incentive here is called the substitution incentive effect, which says, well, gee, I'm paying less in taxes now, so I have an incentive to work more and maybe even save more. But these income effects always dominate these kind of substitution effects, these incentive effects. So the supply-siders who think that cutting taxes at the personal level is going to help the economy, that's not the case. You can't get that out of a neoclassical model, but you can get a very big bang for your buck here from the business tax reform. And part of the story here, Glenn, is that we've got this very high marginal tax rate on investing in the U.S., but we have a very low average corporate tax rate. So we've got the worst of both worlds. We're collecting very little revenue, but we're also kind of keeping companies from operating in the U.S. Or as much as they would otherwise because of the high marginal tax rate. I mean, as an analogy, you could think about the government putting 100% tax on working. We're not in that range. We don't have 100% marginal tax on working. But if we did, we'd collect nobody would work. We'd have no revenue. And then if you lower the tax from, let's say, 100% to 50%, some people would work, we get some revenue. That is an example of a supply-side response where the tax cut could pay for itself. But given where our income tax really is, it's not that kind of situation. Tax cuts aren't going to pay for themselves. That's just voodoo economics, as President George H. Bush described it properly. So I'm not into voodoo economics, but And this model doesn't produce voodoo economics. This is a global model, 17 regions. We've been working on it for about 4 years, a team of economists, and we simulate what happens. And it's, you know, it shows an impact.
Okay, let me ask a political question. I mean, I know you said that this Canadian guy is not a Democrat, he's not a Republican, and I gather that your own arguments here are not being put forward under the color of any particular partisan, stance. But I can't help but observe that when I pick up the New York Times and I read a guy like Paul Krugman, who is a left-wing economist, I think that's fair to say, at least on these kinds of matters, I don't hear any talk about how there could be benefits for workers from reducing the burden, tax burden on corporations. I hear him being dismissive of supply-side economics across the board, not just the Arthur Laffer kind that says if we cut taxes, it's going to pay for itself no matter what, but also the more sophisticated kind that you've just been alluding to, which says that corporations respond to incentives. They choose where to locate and engage in their economic activities. Our tax rates are relatively high in global perspective. Right. The American economy is hurting substantially, including the workers in that economy. We need to cut corporate taxes. Now, the only people I hear saying that kind of thing are Republicans, Larry. Am I wrong?
Mostly, yeah. You have, you know, a lot of nonpartisan economists just are not being consulted. The New York Times, forget Paul, the New York Times writers have been misrepresenting what the House tax reform plan is for like a year now. They keep describing the border adjustment part of the tax as a tax on imports, which it's really not. It's because it's a little bit complicated, but the exchange rate would adjust so that there'd be no change in the relative cost of buying goods from abroad versus buying goods domestically to any consumer. So you need this border tax adjustment, border adjustment, to make sure that you're really taxing all of consumption. And as for Krugman, you know, I think he's given up his card to being an economist just a long time ago. He's really just a political hack at this point. He doesn't really write about economics. He writes about his political views. And he's never studied these issues carefully, so he's never spent, you know, years trying to calibrate a big model, simulate it, and understand what actually would happen. So I don't think he's informed or would be informed. And if he thought the corporate tax was such a great idea, then I would say to him, Paul, are you advocating raising it to 100% or maybe 120% or 150%, you know, make it so high that no corporation in its right mind would like to operate here. He'd say, well, that's crazy. Well, then the question is, well, what, maybe having a 34.6% marginal tax rate is a little crazy too. And maybe you have to think about what this means for workers when you have such a high tax rate and the companies leave the country, whether it's Apple or, you know, we have had a lot of inversions where companies have actually changed their ownership to be foreign ownership. But beyond that, there's just, you know, where are you going to locate your plant? Where are you going to actually produce things here or there? So I think that, and especially given that the corporate tax is not producing much in revenue, we want to get to a tax system that's gives companies incentives to operate here, not the other way around. We can just leave Paul aside. I think I probably said enough about him.
Let me ask you a couple of simple-minded questions. Okay, the home mortgage interest deduction.
Right.
That looks to me like a huge subsidy to the middle, upper middle class. I'm not sure what the rationale for it might have been back in the misty past when it was initially enacted. But I assume that the only, and you correct me, rationale now is that it's impossible to change because too many people are have a stake in it. The home mortgage interest deduction, and what about the deduction for employer-provided health care that all of us are, those of us who have regular employment, relying upon, which is a part of our compensation, but companies get to write it off as part of their expenses and reduce their tax liability in that regard. Another subsidy, not to the rich mainly, but to people, I don't know if you want to include yourself in this or not, you're probably richer than I am, Larry, but people who have good jobs with good benefits. It's a subsidy to us. How can these things be justified? Why are those kinds of changes never on the agenda when we talk about tax reform? How important do you think they are relative to the other kind of things that you've been talking about?
Well, you know, if we're talking about my proposal for how to fix taxes, I would get rid of the mortgage interest deduction. I would get rid of the deductibility of health of health insurance premiums. I would actually get rid of the personal income tax, the corporate income tax, the estate and gift tax. I'd replace them with the following. I would have a 20% value added tax, which again is a consumption tax. I would have a progressive consumption tax that kicks in after $100,000 of consumption, with rates going from 5% up to 30% as you go up the level of consumption. That would be a personal cash flow consumption tax, but you'd be able to deduct your wages so that we wouldn't be doubling up the taxation on wages. I'd also have a $2,000 per head lump sum payment, like a negative tax. I'd have an inheritance tax that kicks in at that would be a 20% inheritance tax that kicks in at after $5 million of inheritance over your lifetime, or gifts or inheritance, you'd have to pay taxes on money above $5 million, and I would get rid of the ceiling on the FICA tax. So if you did all that, the things you just mentioned would go away. You wouldn't have any deductibility of interest income for mortgages. You wouldn't have any break to people that like us who have nice insurance policies, partly paid by employer, by our companies, where the premiums are not being subject to taxation. So I'm with you 100%, but if we just restrict ourselves to the House plan and the Trump plan, one thing to be said here is that by raising the standard deduction, fewer people will actually itemize their deductions, so that there'll be less use made of the mortgage interest deduction. And then for higher income people, I think there is a bit of a phase out of the under the income tax. I'm just trying to remember whether this gets phased out. I don't want to speculate. I'm forgetting on blanking on whether or not that actually is kind of clawed back for people with higher incomes.
That's okay. You can't remember everything, Larry. Your knowledge is already encyclopedic. Yeah. Okay, FICA, you want to get rid of in your plan, which is not on the table. Perhaps I should say, unfortunately, your plan is not on the table. You'd eliminate the upper limit on the FICA tax. What is it now?
It's now $127,500.
Now, this is what, am I correct, 13.5% that's on wages paid to finance this?
It's 12.4%.
12.4%. Half paid by the employee, half paid by the employer. But, of course, all of it is paid in effect by the employee, since that's part of the employee's compensation.
Indeed, you know, the real thing here is that the employer's sending in both parts or electronically to the government. So the idea that it's, you know, paid by the employer, in what sense, you know.
Okay, so we're going to go from something like $120,000 to no limit, which means that somebody making $400,000 is about to get a 12.4% tax increase on the difference between 400,000 and 120. That sounds like a huge tax increase on lower upper income people.
Yeah, it would be a big increase.
Why are you doing it?
Well, Social Security needs the revenue. We need to pay off what we owe. The country is fiscally broke. We need, but if you look at all the components of my proposal, the tax on working at the margin, the marginal tax is 30% for everybody. And that consists of the 15% payroll tax and the effective tax on working under the value added tax I'm proposing, which is 20%, but it's effectively a 15% tax on wages, the way if you work it out. So it's a 30% combined marginal tax on working, no matter whether you're rich or poor. One of our big problems in our country is that we're trapping the poor into poverty. Yeah. If you earn more money, you lose all these benefits, Medicaid, so forth. Yeah. And of course, I'm proposing Medicare Part C for all, which is everybody gets, as we've discussed on your show, So under my plan for healthcare reform, there would be no loss of benefits if you earn more money for the poor. We wouldn't be locking the poor into poverty. So if we're really serious about helping the poor, we got to stop imprisoning them from, you know, basically putting a gun to their head if they earn more money, and forcing them into the underground economy, which where they can avoid or evade taxes. So you need to do Social Security reform, healthcare reform, tax reform together, and you know you need to do it carefully. Trump, as we know, is not knowledgeable about policy issues, and he slapped together his plan for tax reform willy-nilly. It's very unclear about on a lot of issues, but it's also likely to not pay for itself, even if we do get an economic response, because the business tax rates are too low to generate enough revenue to pay for itself. So,
and there's also that avoidance loophole of individuals going corporate or, you know, in sole proprietor individuals and getting a lower rate. So Trump.
I do want to take us back for a second, Glenn, to the border adjustment part of.
Thank you. I did want to get to that too. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, if you look at.
Larry, the opposition to that is fierce. A number of big lobbying centers have come out against it, and I've seen pieces in the press suggesting that it's just Trump trying to blame the Chinese or the NAFTA partners for our problems and so on and so forth. And I think that completely confuses the issue, although maybe I'm wrong. Tell us why you favor the border adjustment tax.
So there are probably 50 countries with value-added taxes, all of which have border adjustment. And it's not that all these countries are taxing imports. That's the characterization of the New York Times reporters when they write about this proposal.
Yeah.
They really are doing a major disservice to the country. Other reporters are following following their lead in describing this part of this House plan as producing a tax on imports. It's not really taxing imports. It's just a way of getting to taxing consumption in total. And the economics of this are when you have this border adjustment, the exchange rate of the U.S. is going to appreciate so that exporters are not going to benefit relative to where they were before, and importers won't benefit or get hurt. So the Walmarts, and Walmart is an example of a company that's been pushing hard against this border adjustment. Now think about this, Glenn. I've already told you that this House plan is something that is getting rid of a wage tax, going to a wealth tax at the business level, and that probably the Republicans don't understand it, and probably the Democrats don't understand it, or you know, the Republicans, if they understood it, they probably wouldn't be pushing.
If they knew how much good they were doing, they'd be against it.
There's a lot of misunderstanding. And then you go to Walmart's, which I'm assuming they don't understand what they're talking about, because we have all these other countries that have adopted value-added taxes over the years with this border adjustment. The WTO, the World Trade Organization, has said that's perfectly fine. That's not putting up a tariff, having this border adjustment. It's just part of taxing consumption. So the notion that they're spreading that this is actually bad for imports, that's a con job, an act of stupidity, because they don't understand. Either they don't understand what they're saying publicly and advertising publicly and pushing their senators from Arkansas to say publicly. They either don't understand it or they do understand it, and what they're doing is trying to con us. Because here's the key interesting thing, which is if you put into place this cash flow tax, but you do not allow the border adjustment, what you end up taxing is the following. You have a consumption tax, a wage subsidy, and then you have an extra subsidy to imports and a tax on exports. You actually subsidize what Walmart is importing. So by a con job, I'm saying that that Walmart's, if they really understand what they're doing, if they really understand fiscal policy and what's really at stake here, they're claiming that they're going to get hurt, but actually in the process of doing that, they're trying to put into place an import subsidy and an export tax. And that's exactly, by the way, the opposite of what Trump campaigned on. So the degree of, I'm going to give Walmart the benefit of the doubt, the Koch brothers the benefit of the doubt, that they just don't understand economics. And they should not be putting ads on TV before they actually talk to a legitimate economist who understands this stuff. Or the problem runs deeper, that they do understand the economics, and they're very subtly trying to get an import subsidy for themselves. I don't know whether the Koch brothers have an interest in, I don't know where the Koch brothers are coming from.
Larry, I am an economist, but I confess to you, I don't understand why it is that a value-added tax without a border adjustment that taxes imports constitutes a subsidy to imports.
Here's how you think about it. Start out with the value-added tax, which is taxing, Y minus C minus, Y minus I minus X minus M, right?
Okay.
The X minus M is the border adjustment. And that turns out to be C, okay? Because Y plus, Y equals
I. No, I get it. Well, everybody perhaps doesn't get it, but so aggregate income is consumption plus investment plus exports minus imports.
Right. So you start out with a national accounting identity and you see, okay, a value-added tax that they're proposing plus, and let's leave the wage subsidy to the side, which is also part of it, but that's not critical here.
Yeah.
The House Republicans are just proposing to tax consumption. So now if you do that, but then you take away the border adjustment, it's like taxing consumption and then changing the base to have a subsidy to imports. So if you rewrite it that way, what they're proposing, which is not to have the border adjustment, that's like taxing all of consumption with a subsidy to net imports.
So that's in effect, they're taxing consumption minus net imports.
Exactly. Right. And minus wages, of course, because that's part of the plan. So the Walmarts, if they really understand what they're doing, are subtly trying to con the country into subsidizing what they are buying in order to resell. And I find that, I find the idea that a U.S. corporation would be putting on ads and pressuring their senators over something that they obviously don't understand appalling. And if they do understand it, it's even more appalling.
Not only do they not understand or deviously do, but many critics, public spokespersons, politicians, op-ed writers and so forth who are center or left of center seem not to understand. I don't think they know that rather than attacking Trump as an idiotic anti-free trader, which is what they think they're doing, they're actually helping Walmart make more profits by importing Chinese goods.
Every time these stupid reporters, I got to call them stupid because they're not doing their homework. I don't think they're unable to figure this out.
Sure.
If they're not calling me or Alan Auerbach or Doug Holtz-Eakin, or there's a whole, there's probably 20 top public finance economists who can sort them out on this, who understand the issues. Then they're not doing their homework. I know Alan, the House Republican business part of their tax reform, of the Better Way tax plan, was really written by Alan Auerbach back in 2010. They basically just grabbed his proposal and added it to their tax reform and put it in their tax reform. Now, Alan's not a right of center or left of center person. He's just a good economist. So, and there's references to my work with Alan and to Alan's plan in this House Better Way plan. So the reporters know who to call to find out about this. I talked to Alan and asked him, we would talk all the time, every day almost, have you been called by any of these reporters? No. Nobody from the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, nobody's calling him or me.
Wow.
We've got the most citations. If you look at the House Better Way plan, there's more citations to our work than anybody. Nobody's calling us. The only person who's calling us is Glenn Lowry.
Yeah.
To speak, right?
Yeah. No. Thanks for that. But they're not calling you because they know what they want to hear, and they're calling the people who are going to tell them that.
Yep.
Wow. So You're not a political prognosticator, but what do you think is going to happen? Are we going to get a major piece of tax reform legislation out of the House of Representatives in this session?
Well, it's, you know, they've got the senators have got themselves confused and pressured. So we've got some Republican senators already on record against the border adjustment. The other aspect of this is that for this to pass, you need to have a certain amount of revenue coming in. The border adjustment, because Congress does 10-year budget window estimates as opposed to infinite horizon present value calculations, which is what I think needs to be done, and I think you do as well.
I do.
Because they're doing the wrong kind of accounting, if you get rid of the border adjustment tax, then you're going to have less revenue counted over the next 10 years, not necessarily less in present value, but less over the next 10 years, because right now imports exceed exports. So when you do the accounting, let me put it this way. If you're taxing consumption, you're subtracting off wages, but you also have a net subsidy to imports, that's going to cost you revenue, right? And if you don't have enough revenue, you can't get this thing passed without the Democrats coming on board.
Sure.
So I think that politically it's difficult to get this thing passed given the misinformation, given the fact that we have a guy at the top who doesn't understand taxation or healthcare or anything deeply enough to really sell the proposal that his party's trying to get across. And instead of trying to understand the House plan, he goes off and undercuts it. So the Republicans cannot agree with each other on the House and Senate side, even within the House. And so it's quite possible we'll never get real health care reform out of the Republicans or anything. I think the plan they passed was terrible. It's cruel. It's nasty. It's a giveaway to the rich because they eliminate high-income Medicare taxes and as part of their overall scheme to have 24 million people not have coverage if their plan is passed relative to what's now the case. So that health care reform is likely not to pass. This tax reform may not get off the ground because it's been mischaracterized. And those are the two centerpieces of the Trump agenda right now. As in addition to building this wall, there's been no money for the wall, but there's also the issue of $1 trillion for infrastructure, which that hasn't actually been brought up for passage either. So you see an economic policy that's kind of collapsing because nobody is good enough to defend it. Who's credible enough to defend it, and certainly not the president. As we were talking here, I saw a news feed on my screen that said that the stock market's having a huge crash right as we're speaking.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah. Well, but, I predicted a big crash about 3 months ago. I pulled out of the market entirely.
Well, a pox on your house and all of your predictions. May they not come true. This is something I want you to be wrong about, Larry. I'm sorry. And one day's fluctuations does not a market crash make, so I'll stay tuned on that.
Okay.
But the news has been a little upsetting in the last few days, what with all this talk about impeachment in the air and stuff, so who knows. Let me ask you about these, and then we should call it a day. But Gary Cohn and Steve Mnuchin, these are the White House economic counselor and the Secretary of the Treasury. They're both from Goldman Sachs. I assume they know something about something, though they may not know very much about economics or about taxation. Yeah. We know who Trump is. Who are these people in your mind as far as being stewards of national policy on tax matters in the administration?
I think the only way you can really understand this stuff is to really understand economics fundamentally. You can't pick it up by selling bonds or by investing in movies, which is what Mnuchin did after he left Goldman, I understand.
Yeah.
So calling Gary Cohen the top economist in our country, or making him the top economist in our country, is really a joke. We might as well make, you know, Joe Blow down the street the top economist in the country. He's not an economist. He doesn't know economic theory. He couldn't deliver a talk in any economics department in the country, top economics, about economics without being laughed off the stage. So
this is an important point. I mean, the position he's holding is a position that was held by Lawrence Summers at one point. And whatever you might think about Larry Summers, he's a damn good economist.
He used to be.
Maybe you can't even agree with that, Larry. I don't know.
I think Krugman used to be a damn good economist and then gave up his economics card when he became a political writer.
Yeah.
And I think Summers, a large part of our economic malaise and failure to really fix so much in the policy area, Social Security, healthcare, education, taxes, banking, really is a result of Summers being pretty much in control of our economic policy for 8 years under Clinton and then 8 years under Obama, either directly or indirectly through his disciples.
But I was only trying to observe that he had a very good-looking veto before he decided to become a politician, he knew how to stand up in front of a professional economics seminar and write stuff on the blackboard that looked like economics.
Yeah, that's true.
That's all I was saying.
Yeah, I'm saying it'd be great to have real economists down in Washington, but they have to be real economists who actually put economics first and policy, and not just say what their masters want to hear, because that's the problem with everybody's going down to work at the Council of Economic Advice. Not every single person, but the vast majority of people going to work for Bush or for Clinton or Obama, they are very political. You know, they don't think about what's best for the economy, for the country, for the next generation. It's all about, is this good for getting my guy reelected? Is this the Democratic Party line? If you look at a column by Ed Lazier or John Taylor, who have held positions of importance, it's always going to be right of center in terms of where they're coming down. You're never going to hear something that contradicts the party line of the Republicans. Same thing, Glenn Hubbard, same thing. If you look at Jason Furman or Larry Summers, if they write columns, again, it's always going to be hewing to the party line. It's Krugman again. That's not what economics is about. It's almost like doctors deciding what diagnosis to give based on some political affiliation.
I think this has practical implications, what you're observing. We can infer something about, there's this beautiful paper that's getting ready to come out in Econometrica by Mohamed Yildiz at MIT and Rajiv Sethi at Columbia. It's called Communication with Unknown Perspectives. And what they argue in this beautiful paper, Larry, is that when individuals are trying to decide who to listen to get advice, some experts are better than others. The noise on their signal has lower variance, okay? They just are smarter. But people have biases. They have, like prior beliefs that they come in with. So now if all you hear is their opinion, suppose you don't know the state of the world, the expert sees a signal, and then he tells you what his forecast is. Crudely, his forecast is going to be a convex combination of his signal and his prior. Okay? If I know the guy's prior, I know how to interpret his forecast to infer what his signal is to form my own opinion. Right. But if I don't know his prior, I've got a signal extraction problem. He tells me what his opinion is, and I have to figure out from that, working backwards, what information he's got versus what prior bias that he's had. So there are two kinds of experts. There are experts that I know who are very smart, but I don't know where they're coming from. And right. Then there are experts who might not be quite as sharp, but I know exactly the character of their bias. So they play with this trade-off. The observation I want to make is, if I see a guy or a woman who are in the business of making predictions, forecasts, and commentary on economic advances, and everything they say lines up with one side of the political spectrum,
You can't believe it.
Gotta know that they're biased, and therefore I have to completely discount them, no matter how many honorary degrees they may have and how many chairs at universities that they may have held. We ought to put that to work. People should surprise us from time to time if we want them to be, if they want to be taken seriously as expounders of opinions about this or that. They ought to surprise us from time to time by having opinions that we wouldn't necessarily have projected them to have based upon what we think are their political orientation.
Yeah, I mean, and you got to do your homework. You can't just get up there and, you know, Alan and I spent, we developed this analysis of the tax reform, of its progressivity. It was, it's basically been a three-year effort just to get the model up and running to do it, and then about 6 months to get the House plan properly analyzed. And so it's not, you know, trivial. You gotta really do your homework to get this right. I think for people that you know what they're going to say before you actually read whatever they write on a particular topic, you see the title of their column and you know what the answer is going to be. They're people you shouldn't pay any attention to because they're not economists anymore. They are political hacks. And unfortunately, somehow our profession has given license of people that we presumably respect to go and behave this way, as opposed to saying, look, no, you're representing the profession when you go down to Washington. First and foremost, you're a professional economist. Your job is not to get this guy elected. Your job is to help the country and tell the truth about economics. And that's it. And if you get fired, you get fired. So much the better. You've proven your worth. So
a Hippocratic oath for economics advisors.
Exactly.
I like it.
Go to Washington, get fired, or you're not doing your job.
Larry, thanks for coming on the Glenn Show. This is Larry Kotlikoff. He's at kotlikoff.net. And you'll find a link there to his recent Wall Street Journal article, as well as to many other treasures from one of my favorite economists. So, Larry, we'll do it again.
Great, Glenn. Well, you're my favorite. So,
shucks.
We got an economics love match going. Okay.
Sounds good, man. My friend. Take care of yourself now.
Ciao, Glenn. Ciao.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.